everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Thoughtful Thursday. Every Thursday, you and I have the opportunity to hear from an expert who is able to give us information to really sort of expand our own sense of what's true in the world. I have to tell you, today's guest is absolutely the perfect person for Thoughtful Thursday. I am very pleased to introduce to you Dr. Tina Sherman Sellers. Dr. Sellers is a licensed marriage and family therapist, a certified sex therapist, and she's also a professor of sexuality and medical family therapy at the Graduate Family Therapy Department at the Seattle Pacific University. I'm sorry, that's Seattle Pacific University. That is a mouthful, Dr. Tina Sherman Sellers, at Shermer Sellers, I'm sorry. And you are the author of Sex, God, and the Conservative Church. That doesn't seem to belong in the same title.
That's right, it doesn't. Thank you so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, let me start from the beginning. Sex, God, and the Conservative Church, erasing shame from sexual intimacy. You have to sort of lay the framework for us because, again, I did a double take when I saw the book title. So what's
right.
going on with this?
Well, you know, What actually ended up happening for me, I've been teaching the graduate human sexuality course at Seattle Pacific for marriage and family therapists for about 25 years. And one of the things that I began to notice in the early 2000s was that the stories that my students were telling me in office hours and that my clients were telling me, those in particular that had come from conservative religious backgrounds, began to dramatically change. And what I was hearing was dramatic increase in sexual shame and in ways that I had not ever heard it before. And they were describing significant increases in sexual dysfunction, in disgust about their bodies, in humiliation, and in just feeling incredibly ignorant about sexuality. And the stories were tragic in many ways. And I had not heard things like this before. And it took a while for it to dawn on me what I was actually seeing. I had to ask some questions because I didn't understand what I was seeing. And what I began to realize as I was listening and talking to students was I began to see that I had stumbled upon young men and women who had reached their early adulthood, but they had come through the evangelical purity movement. And in brief, this is a movement that got started in about 1992 or so, and it grew out of the religious right movement. And it was a movement that started in through the Southern Baptist Church, and it was a very conservative sexual ethic that basically said that sexuality, all sexuality, belonged inside a heterosexual marriage, but it wasn't just your actions; it now included your thoughts and your feelings, and so you needed to remain pure in thought and in your heart and in your action. And so youth would sign purity pledges and they would wear purity rings, and there were rallies. And in these rallies, there were very dramatic examples that they were given on how this purity was to be lived out. And some of the examples are incredibly graphic. For example, they would hold up a piece of foil that had no blemishes on it at all, and then they would say, "This is you when you have had no sexual thoughts, when you are pure, and this is the way you want to remain because this is what God wants." And then they would talk about if there had been any acting out at all. And then they would crumble the foil. And then they would fold it back out again. They would say, and you can never go back. You can never go back. Or they would pass around a flower and they would ask everybody to pluck a petal off of it as they were talking about how important it was that you remain pure. And then at the end, they would hold up this, you know, stem of a flower and they would say, this would be all you would have to give to your partner. So very dramatic things like this. So what would happen is these people would shut themselves down neurobiologically, you know, in their mind and in their heart and in their body. And what they would find out is even if they had done everything they could to not act on their sexual desires before they got married, there was no switch that went off when they did get married. And they ended up with significant sexual problems when they were married. And then those, of course, there are many, of course, who, because it's very natural, I believe we are hardwired for connection and pleasure, who did, of course, you know, have a crush or date somebody or whatever, and they felt horrible about themselves. They thought, there must be something fundamentally wrong with me. So this really changed the trajectory of my career, and I began to ask some very fundamental questions about, what is this? How did this happen? Did the Christian church ever get a sexual ethic right that really matched the ministry of Jesus? So I began to ask some very fundamental questions that took me on a journey, an 11-year journey of research, and thus culminated in the writing of this book.
Well, early on in your book, you acknowledge a particular community organization with a website. And I have to tell you that as I was reading, I thought, okay, if there's somebody reading this book who is from a very, very conservative household, the name of the website is going to send them into the tailspin. The website name, why don't you tell folks the name of this website?
The name of the website is thankgodforsex.org. And it grew out of, I was having so many conversations. This was maybe about 4 or 5 years ago now, so I'm well into this project. And by this point, I've done so much speaking and having conversations that I've become relatively known in my area. And I've got youth coming to me, and youth people in their 20s and early 30s coming to me, and just wanting to sit and talk because they have no safe place to go to have conversations. And so it's really on my heart and on my mind. And there is a project that got started in, I believe, 2010 by Dan Savage and his partner, Terry Miller, called itgetsbetter.org. And it's a very big project. And it happened after there was a series of gay kids that had committed suicide. And it's a project, it's an online community of people who have shot videos of themselves, who many of them are gay or lesbian, and they've shot videos of themselves saying, I remember what it was like being an adolescent, and it gets better, please hang in there, here's what my story is. And they've shot videos. Well, there's now tens of thousands of videos, and some of them are parents, and some of them are pastors, and gay and straight, and some very, very famous people. And it's been a wonderful project in encouraging kids to hang in there and obviously not commit suicide. So I had a flash in the middle of the night. I often say to my daughter, the time I do my best thinking is in the middle of the night. And I had a flash in the middle of the night, and I thought, gosh, you know, one of the things that's different about the community of evangelical kids that I'm talking to is they don't have anyone to talk to. They don't feel safe in telling anyone about their experience around their sexual development, whether or not they did their very best to remain pure, or whether or not they feel like they, you know, messed up or whatever. No one feels safe to tell anyone their story. So they've been in profound isolation for so long. What if we had a website where at least those people that had been going to therapy and trying to heal could tell their story so that you could go to a website and hear people telling their story and know that you weren't alone. What if we did that? So I went to the, you know, a small group of about five or six people in their 20s and 30s that were, you know, down the road a bit. And I said, what do you think about doing this, about something similar to the It Gets Better project? And they were completely on board. And they said, let's do it. Let's do this. And so that's how the whole project got started. I called my son, who does graphic design, and I said, can you come up with, you know, some kind of a logo for us? And we literally started shooting videos like the next week. And then we started getting calls from people saying, I'm ready to tell my story. I'll tell my story. And it's been really that project has ran on its own. I've done very little except for just say it's here, and if it can be useful to anybody, please, you know, let us know how we can help you.
Well, so, yeah. Let me ask you about the conservative church. I'm going to guess that a couple of folks have perhaps read your book and have been, I don't know, maybe horrified. You say that God never intended for there to be sexual shame. So what kind of feedback are you getting from people?
Well, you know, a lot of people think that I must have been getting horrible feedback for my, you know, the entire time I've been working on this. And I teach at an evangelical Christian university. Now, mind you, I teach in a graduate program. However, I've had tremendous support, and I don't get as much pushback as most people think. Although I think one of the things that's important to be clear is I never intended to write this book in any way to be something to challenge people's opinions or beliefs if they are content with their beliefs that they have right now. If people are content with where they are and where they settle, terrific, stay there. This book is really written for the droves of youth and people who are leaving the church because they can't find a place for themselves. There's some, I think, some very interesting things happening in the under the broad umbrella of the Christian church in America right now. And one of the things that I see that's happening and where I would say that there's a split in the church is that on the far conservative side of the Christian church is an organization around beliefs. And these beliefs determine whether you are in or whether you are out. And it's not really said overtly this way, but you can see it organizing people this way. And the beliefs are, you know, anti-abortion, anti-gay, pro-heterosexual marriage, pro-gender binary, pro-GOP, these kinds of things. And if you are these things, then clearly you must be a Christian. And if you do not believe these things, then, well, we're kind of questioning your Christianity. Well, there are so many people and definitely so many millennials who feel like I either don't fit this or I have people that I love that don't fit this. And I don't feel like I can ascribe to be in this camp. And we're just watching many of them leave. And their story, whatever their story is not finding an audience. It's not finding a place that's saying, I care about you and I care about your story and I care about what you want to teach me and what you have to say to me. And then I think that there is a whole nother camp of very devout Christians that are saying, you know, we're not organizing around beliefs. We are organizing around a way of life. We are actually very, very interested in how Jesus lived. We are interested in being a more just and generous faith that's built on love and justice and grace and mercy. And this really allows for open conversation, and it invites everyone to the table. And it realizes that there are going to be differences, and yet differences aren't about judging who's in and out. It's just about recognizing that there are differences. And I, you know, I've seen this in how the Jewish faith has been for thousands of years. And so I think that, this is something that's going on in the Christian faith in general in the United States. And I think that my heart actually was just really feeling for the people that were hurting and so isolated and just didn't have an audience. And I think as a therapist, and I think as a person, I'm actually pretty crafted this way. That's really where my heart went. And I feel like if people are fine in their community and in their camp and with their people around them and their beliefs are fine for them, great. I'm not here to change you at all, but my heart is really with those people that don't feel like there is an audience for them. And I really want this book to be a place of healing and solidarity. And there are, you know, there were 4 million youth that signed these purity pledges. And when I wrote an original article in 2006, and I got letters from people around the globe saying, no one has talked about sexuality the way that you are and has named the pain that people have been in like you are. And I realized I hit a chord. And I was seeing, what I was seeing from people was actual signs and symptoms that matched someone that had experienced childhood sexual abuse. And I knew nobody was saying this. So I believe that if we're doing something that's truly Christian, we're going to see the fruits of that in someone's life. So I knew that the exit that we were proposing through the purity movement was certainly not producing those fruits in people's lives. So we must have been doing something wrong.
You, at the beginning of your book, you talk about a therapy session with a young couple that you've called Marta and Justin. Do you recall that couple?
Yes, I do.
Can you tell us a little bit about them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was a couple that had met in college, and she had come from a family that was, I think, more from a Jewish faith background, and had, if I remember, had a very intellectual and rich conversations and kind of heated conversations as she was growing up. And he had come from, I think, a Midwest, very conservative background. And they had met in college, both in law school, and deeply loved each other. It was probably one, I know for him, it was the first very deep relationship he had ever had, and for her, certainly the most significant relationship she had ever had, and they deeply loved each other. And he really felt like he could not speak even about the depth of his love to anybody from back home that he had grown up with, because he had come through this purity movement, because everything that he said called his feelings into question, even because if you speak of your love for somebody, then obviously there must be sexual feelings underneath that. Like, you know, who are your accountability partners if you're feeling this strongly about somebody, for example? And so he just felt just tied up in knots about this. And she just couldn't understand, why aren't we able to progress in our relationship? You know, we have these deep feelings for each other. It feels like our physical relationship should be able to progress, you know, equally along the way. And he just was tied in knots. Like, I don't feel like we can go anywhere with our physical relationship. And I'm even struggling with our emotional relationship. And, you know, it was just horrible for them. And she really felt like, in her mind, even from an intellectual place, that this, there were power differentials that were here, that this was a patriarchal move on his part. And yet this wasn't at all matching with the person she knew him to be. So it really, they came in completely tied in knots and with no language with which to talk about this at all. And so we just had a lot of unpacking to do. And So this was where knowing the history of the church was really helpful for us to give some context and to just kind of work together very slowly while honoring that these were very caring, very loving people, and nobody was acting in any way that needed to pathologize the other. They were doing the best they could,
which I
so
think
we just needed to go.
Which is so key, I think, to not create an environment where there was something wrong with both of them,
right.
of them. Dr. Sellers, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'd like to continue with Marta and Justin and what kind of work you were able to do with them. Folks,
great.
This is Dr. Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, having a conversation with Dr. Tina Shermer Sellers, who is the author of Sex, God, and the Conservative Church. We'll be right back. Conversation between Marta and Justin certainly sounds like it was a painful one for both of them. And, you know, there are so many myths, as you well know, about men and women. So it's of note that it was the woman who was saying what's going on with their sex life or the lack thereof. And it was the man who was really in a lot of pain around not believing that sex before marriage was okay. And in fact, believing that sex before marriage was actually harmful to the relationship. And it's not so much about when the sex occurs, but how they were both feeling about their sexual selves.
Right, exactly. And I think one thing to punctuate here is that initially, Justin was even struggling with his desires to be sexually intimate. And I want to be clear when I say sexually intimate, I'm not just, because we're talking about a heterosexual couple here, I'm not just talking about intercourse. I'm talking about pretty much all forms of connection and pleasure. So, because if you grew up under the purity movement, your thoughts and your desires are also called into question. So he was struggling profoundly because he loved her deeply. And so as those, you know, deep love thoughts would drift towards wanting to share that with her on any level, that would become intimate, you know, around connection and pleasure, it would drift into him beginning to feel shame, profound shame, which, you know, shame pulls us into a place of not feeling worthy, you know, beginning to just question our own worth. And when this has happened for you inside a religious context, that worth is not just, am I worthy of love and belonging, but does God believe I'm worthy of love and belonging? So it hits us at profound levels. One of the things we know recently about the impact of sexual shame is that it's a visceral feeling of humiliation and disgust towards one's own body and identity as a sexual being. And it can have a deep effect on our belief of being, are we normal? Are we abnormal? It can affect people and cause them to feel inferior. It can manifest in whether or not we can trust well or communicate well, our desires for emotional or physical intimacy. And it develops across the lifespan in this sort of circular fashion where it happens in our interpersonal relationship, but then it translates into this subsequent critical self-appraisal that happens internally where we're, you know, we get this internal dialogue going like, oh, you know, this is what's wrong with me. And then it externalizes itself again in an interpersonal relationship, and then it goes internal again. And so for many of these kids that were in the purity movement, this feedback loop, if you will, of internal, external, internal, external, had really been going for a decade before they ended up, for many of them, in a significant relationship that they really wanted to see go to fruition or end up in a long-term relationship, which was true for Justin and Marta. So he felt really caught. And then the people that he wanted to talk to back home were not people who could hear him at all, because they immediately started to call into question, well, who are your accountability partners at school? Because obviously you're feeling so strongly about her, you must really be struggling with your sexuality. I mean, immediately nobody could hear the depth of his real struggle. We could really listen to him. So we had to honor first and foremost, how important his faith was to him, and that we needed to talk about that he was fundamentally created to be wired for connection and pleasure, that this is the way God made him, and find a way to acknowledge that while doing that in the context of his faith, which meant that we had to talk about his faith from a wider context than the purity movement. So we had to go back in history. We couldn't talk about it from the early 80s forward. We had to go further back. And so that we could find a way for him to connect to the God that he loved, but from a much, much wider perspective. And we couldn't move forward in their relationship until he knew that he was still being very true to the God that he loved. And that was important to her too, because she wanted to honor him. I mean, she loved him and loved who he was as a person of integrity. So it's very important to me to not undermine somebody's faith. That's part of why I wrote this book, because I've watched so many people throw the baby out with the bathwater, throw their faith away in order to feel like they needed to honor their sexuality, which they can't change, you know, so they throw out their faith. And what I'm able to show in this book is that you don't have to throw your faith away at all. So God created you the way you are on purpose, and that is as a sexual being. So that's how we worked.
Well, then how does one navigate between, this is what I have spent X number of hours, minutes, years believing, and now I'm learning something else? So I'm thinking there would be some sense of grief, anger, loss around the shifting sense of their lives. How do they deal with that?
Absolutely. Really, I mean, I don't mean to be trite, but you deal with it like you deal with any kind of grief. It doesn't happen overnight. There is that whole process of, you know, first struggling with even believing it, and then second, having, you know, just a lot of denial and anger, and, you know, you walk with people through it, and you hold them well, and you love them well, and you help them separate the difference between where the church got it wrong, because it was made up of people, and we look in a mirror dimly, you know, we're not seeing things clearly, and we are prone to foolishness, and we can see this across the development of the church, all kinds of ways in which really, the church in many, many places across history was much more informed by socio-political movements than it was by the ministry of Jesus, the core values of Jesus' ministry. We can see that. And this is the nature of humans. It's the nature of the fall. And we see this. And you know, that was not intentional. And people are not creating things, I think, intentionally to be foolish, but this is how we are. And so it takes a while for people to separate what was from human foolishness and where is God and where is God's love and where has God been holding me and protecting me and caring for me in the midst of this. And so people are able to do that eventually as they sort of sift through all of this. And so really there's a kind of a circular four-part process that happens as you're working with people. And one of them, I call it frame, name, claim, and aim. So frame is you help people get the sexual education that they never got, that helps them understand actually their bodies and emotional intelligence. So help them get their sex education, help them get their emotional education, interpersonal education, intimacy education, and you help them develop those core pieces of how you do an intimate long-term relationship over time well. So you're helping them get that. You help them tell their particular story of growing up. That's the main part. And you help them find a community of people that are safe and who can hear their story in compassion and empathy. And as people find a safe, empathic tribe of people can do that, shame can't exist in when it's told, when the story is told. And that's really what my book helps people do, is people can gather around the book, they can read the book in community, and it will guide people through this entire process. And that's very helpful. Claim is really claiming back your body. When we live in a culture like ours that is constantly telling you that your body isn't okay, and then the church is telling you that nothing about your body can be trusted, that it pulls you constantly away from God, which in fact can't be true if God manifested himself through the embodied incarnation of God's self here on earth, then we have to reclaim the body as a source of knowing God. So that's a whole process of claiming back your body and saying, this body is good. It allows me to live out my soul, to love here on earth. So that's a whole body, a process of claiming back your body. And then aiming is really rewriting the legacy that you want for what sexual health is going to be for you and letting go of the legacy that you were handed, so that when you pass down a legacy now to any children that are in your life, whether they're your own or other people's who you're close to, you're passing down a new legacy that feels congruent to you. So this is a process that you do kind of in a circular fashion over and over. And eventually what you find is the shame falls off with it as you rewrite your own story. And it knits you together. And this is what happened for Marta and Justin, is that it knit them together as they did this together. And they grew in compassion as they understood each other's stories. And it was a lovely process for them to do together. And I think what was also so important about it is that I think so many therapists would have looked at this and said, oh, Justin's the problem, and would have taken him and put him with an individual therapist or something. And it was so important that Marta be with him as he figured this out and shared his story and she be a witness to his story. And there was so much from Marta's background that he needed to hear and understand. And it really knit them together. So that was another very important piece of their work.
Well, it sounds like they were able to experience intimacy really in its truest, most fullest form.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
What are, as you talked about doing your research for many years, what are some of the pieces of broadened awareness, if you will, that you would like for the listeners to understand about sex and sexuality and their belief in God?
Well, you know, one of the key questions that I asked right up front was, and I guess I should say as a disclaimer that my heritage is Swedish, and Swedes are known for being particularly stubborn, and I think I got an extra dose of it. So I just think I just wasn't going to stop until I got a satisfying answer. So my question that I threw down right away was, did the church ever get it right? Did we ever have a sex positive sexual ethic? Because if God, I mean, I already was a sex therapist, so I believe that God crafted our bodies on purpose, and I could see how we were hardwired for connection and pleasure. Infants are born, and they are immediately seeking the breast, and yet it's not because they're hungry. We know that the milk doesn't come down for 3 days or so, and yet they're rooting, they're turning towards the smell of their mother, and, you know, there's just all that need for just deep connection and holding. We know that young children, if they don't get enough warm holding and loving touch, that they'll have neurological damage. You can walk down the halls of an Alzheimer's unit and you don't have to have memory, and you will see people still seeking connection and pleasure. So we know this is hardwired into the human experience. God has crafted us this way. So you can't argue with that as far as I'm concerned. So I thought, well, did we ever get that right? Did we ever connect that to an ethic that helped us understand why we were created for deep connection and pleasure? So I have always have grad students every year, you know, two or more people that work with me and help me do research. And so for years, we just traced back the Christian history looking for, did we ever have this right? And we kept finding another ascetic movement that just would say that, you know, the body's bad and this is how we controlled people or whatever. Went back. We couldn't find anything. So I said, okay, well, we're not stopping. We're going to keep going. So we went back into Jewish history. And then we started to find these remarkably beautiful stories and historical facts that actually just blew me out of the water. And I can remember having times, I can remember one time I was camping with my family, and I, you know, was always hauling books with me, you know, and I was reading this one Jewish tome, and I find this one story, and I thought to myself, oh, I can't tell anybody because this is almost too much to believe. I better get this confirmed in like three other sources before I tell anybody, because nobody's going to believe me. And what it was, and this is one of, yeah, I don't know, 6-7 stories. And I've written on this in many places before I put it in the book. But so most of us know that inside the Holy of Holies in the Jewish temples, that there were always cherubim over the Ark of the Covenant and on the two staffs that denoted an aspect of God's character. And often we think of it as, you know, the cherubim had their wings out showing God's protection over the people. I mean, that's always what I heard. And actually, and that was true, I think, in one of the temples. But the very last temple that was destroyed in 72 AD, the cherubim in that temple, the cherubim were in seated sexual embrace. And when I read that, when I was away camping, I kind of looked around and I thought, if I tell anybody, they won't believe me.
Okay, my mouth dropped open. So,
right?
Dr. Sellers, I've got to interrupt you. I'm so sorry, but we need to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to pick up exactly here, and I'm going to try to close my mouth. Folks, don't go away. We'll return in just a moment with Dr. Tina Shermer Sellers, author of Sex, God, and the Conservative Church, Erasing Shame from Sexual Intimacy. We'll return in a moment. Dr. Sellers, let's continue to talk about your findings.
Mm-hmm. So you want me to pick up with that story there?
Yeah, I've got my mouth closed now, so I'm ready to listen.
Okay. So I found that, and I did, in fact, find it confirmed in several other sources. And what the first century rabbis would do is they would, the other people of the temple couldn't go into the Holy of Holies. Only the rabbis could, and in the Day of Atonement. So, but what the rabbi would do is periodically pull aside the big curtain, the paraclete, pull it aside so that the people could look in, and would say to the people, the first century rabbis would say to the people, this is so you can know that God loves you like a lover and longs for you like a lover. And when I read that, I thought to myself, you know, it would change everything for Christians to think of God not just as a father who protects us, but as somebody who loves us, longs for us like a lover. And, you know, when you think about when you're first in love, that person is on your mind all the time. And you want nothing more than to just be right with them, listening to them. You long for them. They are your beloved. And I believe that God thinks of us that way, and probably much, much more than, you know, probably any human experience that we've ever had. And when you go through the Jewish stories, you see that they are so much more comfortable with sexuality than Christians have ever been, and with the body. In fact, they believe, and if you talk to Orthodox Jews, they will tell you this, that if you make love on the Sabbath, it's a double blessing. They believe that the coming together of making love is the bringing together of the masculine, the feminine energies that exist within both people, and that when you bring those together, the creative energy of God is right there between them. That this is a deep blessing. And they're all throughout. In fact, another rabbi's work that I read talked about how one rabbi speaks of the Song of Songs as the Holy of Holies of the entire Torah, that the rest of the Torah points to the Song of Songs. And the Song of Songs reminds us that we are God's beloved. And the rest of the Torah serves that message. So there's this way in which just deep longing, deep lovemaking, body, mind, heart, and soul, which is another way that the Jewish people think about loving and lovemaking, is that it's not a body thing only. It's something that always involves the heart, mind, soul, and body. In fact, there's a parallel process in Jewish thinking that the preparation that a rabbi does to enter the Holy of Holies is the same preparation that committed couples enter into before they make love to each other, that you prepare your heart, your mind, your soul, and your body, and you come to each other with that kind of presence of heart, of mind, of soul, and of body, and that when you do, a very different experience occurs. You keep a fire, you keep a desire alive, and nothing turns to ash. And there's this idea that if you enter the Holy of Holies in the Jewish temple without preparing adequately, you'll be turned to ash. And the same parallel, that if you treat your lovemaking in a cavalier way, it will eventually turn your desire to ash. And I see that all the time in my office. People who have turned their lovemaking into a transactional or obligatory experience, eventually somebody's like, wow, this is no fun anymore. You know, this is boring. So anyway, there are just so many beautiful, amazing, incredible stories. In fact, I found a sex positive sexual ethic that was a combination of Jewish fertility guidelines and this thing called a vow of Ona, that blew my mind, that we could easily be raising our children with and easily apply to long-term relationships. And if we followed it, would like make every relationship work seriously and give us exactly what we need to raise our children. And I have that in the book.
Okay.
It's mind-blowing to me.
Okay, so now that you've really raised everybody's curiosity, you got to tell us what you found.
I've got a what?
You have to tell us what you found.
So in this valve, and I'll just give you a couple of things in there, but for example, one of the guidelines in this valve onan in the fertility guidelines, one of them is that sexual touch is a woman's right and not a man's. And this is a core valve onan guideline. And this is required of men. Boys are actually still taught this in Jewish day school. There are three things that men are responsible for. That is to provide her food, shelter, and sexual touch. And in the sexual touch, what he's required to give her is that every sexual touch must, for her, provide pleasure and joy. And it's on her terms. Now, that will blow you away just in and of itself in America, because we do exactly the opposite here.
Indeed.
But it's important to think of it on an even deeper level. If we raised our boys, which they do in many Jewish households, to know that, and this is what I want to say here, this is especially true in heterosexual relationships, because these are the relationships that struggle the most, I believe, and I see it all the time. If you raise your heterosexual boys to know that you are going to need to study the woman, you are going to need to understand her, because she is different than you. And he grows up learning that relationship and who she is, he's accountable to that. Then he begins to take his eyes off himself and learn to study other. Now, this is a natural growing edge for men that men don't often get to until midlife. Midlife is where men naturally begin to go, oh, it's my relationships that are so important to me, that ground my purpose in my life, that make my purpose, all my hard work makes sense for me. But that naturally comes for men in midlife. When we get boys doing this sooner, they begin to feel more whole and more grounded in their late 20s, early 30s, instead of their late 40s, early 50s. Big difference for the quality of life for men. For girls, if you grow up learning that, a heterosexual girl, that the men in your life, the only one worth dating is the one that's going to make it about you, and that you need to know that your pleasure is important, and that you are treated that way, then you now have a much higher standard for yourself, and you know that your pleasure is important. And so you take responsibility for your pleasure. Well, what we know from research, from Emily Nagowski's research, for some of the work that Esther Perel does, is that women only enjoy their sexuality when they're comfortable about making it about them. When they can let go, when they can say, this is what I like. And they know that it's okay, that not only is it okay, it's great. Well, when do women finally get around to doing that naturally? Not until they're in their 40s. That's when they finally go, you know what, I'm tired of taking care of everybody else. You know, it's going to be about me now for a while. Women don't naturally let go of all that cultural stuff until later in their life. Well, when we raise girls this way, they can start to do that so much sooner. So now we have heterosexual relationships who at an intimate level are starting to really bond in their 30s when they have children, instead of after they've launched their children and when so many people have already divorced. So to me, this is profound that the Jewish people figured this out thousands of years ago, and we're still clueless.
And, you know, as I'm listening to you discuss your findings, I'm thinking about the fact that what you have found and certainly what you have written really go, from my perspective, goes beyond those who find themselves experiencing shame that has grown out of their religious teachings. I mean, you know, there are so many ways in which human beings are taught to feel shame, and certainly shame about their bodies for any number of reasons, that it just seems to me that you have written your book in such a context that it's really available and useful and profound for anyone, whether or not they perceive themselves as having grown up in a conservative religious background.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've asked, you know, people wherever I've been speaking or courses or whatever, you know, raise your hand if you grew up in a home that was very open about sexuality, taught you about your body and sexuality and gender and relationships from your earliest memory, and it was an ongoing, open, safe conversation. Raise your hand if that was you. Hardly any hands ever go up. So I would say somewhere between 85 to 95% of families are silent or silent and shaming. And if you trace that story back, you'll eventually find something having to do with religion. Almost always. We are one of the few industrialized countries in the world that has no comprehensive sex education. And we've very recently come out of about 30 years of abstinence only, which is no education.
Right.
I mean, absolutely nothing. So we have so much sexual shame. And what we don't understand is that sexual shame doesn't just affect us sexually. It affects us at our ability to do intimate relationships, our ability to give and receive love, our ability to do attachment. So you can't hurt anybody at any deeper level than to hurt them at their ability to do deep attached relationships. And that's what we've done by not doing sexuality well in the church and outside of the church. So to me, this is just a fundamental problem for us. And that's what I'm trying to address in this book.
And
by giving the history, you know, and by saying, here's how we heal.
And I noticed, and so I want to point out that you've got some chapters that are specifically targeted towards therapists who will have their own challenges potentially in identifying and working with these issues personally as human beings themselves, but also with their clients.
Right, exactly. One of the things that I think has become very clear for me in doing this research and work is that therapists of all ilk, so social workers, counselors, marriage and family therapists, psychologists, and then I would also say physicians, don't get training in sexuality for the most part, maybe get one class. And yet everyone that they see, at least 50% of them, we know from research, has some sexual concern. And yet we do not train around sexuality, sexual dysfunction, just the whole gamut, really. And so the vast majority of practitioners grew up in a silent or silent and shaming country, did not get enough of their own, and then did not get adequate training in their own professional training. So this is a problem. And so I address that in the book, and I'm really trying to encourage people to please take this seriously and get yourself some more training. Because just because we don't have it in our graduate schools is not an excuse to sit back and not recognize this for yourself. And the other problem is that people who get training just to be like what I would call a clinical sexologist may not have training in what we call family systems. So the couple dynamic or the family system dynamic. So if you only are trained in individual like intrapsychic, you know, how things fit somebody on the inside, but not the dynamic of a relationship, then you can inadvertently, like I was sort of hinting to when I was talking about Martha and Justin, you could very easily see something as a individual problem that really is a couple dynamic, and where you really need to work on the issue with the couple. And if you work on it just with the individual, what I've seen happen for so many people is they end up participating in splitting the couple up. And many, many therapists who are not trained in systems or couple dynamics or family system dynamics end up causing more damage than good. So that's one of the things I try to address in the last chapter of the book is, you have a responsibility if you're going to be working in this field to check yourself on your training. And if you don't have enough, because we all are responsible to continue to get continuing education units. That's part of our professional growth, you know, to make sure that you've got enough, both in the area of sexuality and in the area of systems training.
The comprehensive way in which you have approached this subject is something that certainly I very much appreciate. And I completely agree with you and support your statement that going back and looking at the history so that you can teach clients the history of sex and sexuality and the truth of what it was intended to mean and to represent in people's lives is just so critically important. I have to thank you for the work that you've done.
Yes, you're so welcome. It's actually been a wonderful experience for me as well.
Dr. Tina Shermer Sellers, author of Sex, God, and the Conservative Church, Erasing Shame from Sexual Intimacy. Tell us there's a website where we can go for more information.
There is. You can go to TinaShermerSellers.com. So that's TinaShermer Sellers, SELLERS.com. Or you can go to thankgodforsex.org. And either one of those places, there'll be information on the book, and the book's available at Amazon and or any of the booksellers. Yeah. And you can learn more about us and me and kinds of things.
Terrific. Yeah. Thank you again so much. This has really been a fascinating and I'm hoping for the listeners, incredibly useful conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Pamela. I have appreciated being with you.
And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service. It is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. It is available to you on demand at mindtalk.org. That's MYNDTALK.org. You can subscribe to the Mind Talk podcast via iTunes. You can also download the Mind Talk app from the iTunes Store or the Google Play Store, all free of charge. I would love to know where in the world you are as you're listening to this edition of Mind Talk. So send me an email. Let me know. Pamela, P-A-M-E-L-A, at mindtalk.org. Again, MYNDTALK.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then it's unacceptable. You take care.